Tonight's lecture is dedicated to the memory of Chantzi Bas Reb Mordechai, the wife of Yossi Tepfer, who passed away at the very young age of 27 on the 14th day of Tammuz in the year 5747. The Torah and tzedakah of her husband and family should be le'ilui nishmosa. The topic for tonight is the relationship of the kingdoms of Assyria, of Ashur, and of Babylonia, of Bavel, the relationships between themselves and the relationships regarding the Jewish people. As we have seen, these two kingdoms were primarily responsible for the destruction of the first Jewish commonwealth. Ashur was the country that conquered the northern kingdom and exiled the 10 tribes to a place that we know not where they are. And Bavel is the successor kingdom to Ashur that eventually came and exiled the tribes of Yehuda and Binyamin, burned the first temple, destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and effectively ended the period of the first Beis Hamikdash and of the first commonwealth of the Jewish people. Now, Ashur and Bavel occupied roughly the same area of geography in the Middle East. We're talking here about the valley of the Euphrates and the Tigris, the strips of land that lie on either side of the Tigris River, the Hiddekel, and the Nahar Pros, the Euphrates River, and the delta of land that lies between the two rivers. To a great extent, that's the cradle of civilization. That's where the world began, where civilization began as we know it. Ashur occupied the more northern edge of that territory, and Bavel occupied the more southern end of the territory. In other words, Bavel occupied the territory from, let us say, the Persian Gulf, approximately 45, 50 miles north. And then north of that area is the area where Ashur lived. They are somewhat the same peoples, but they are not quite the same people. They are both of Semitic stock. They're both from the family, really, of Avraham Avinu, from the family that we come from. And the language that they both had was approximately the same. The language is called the ancient language of Akkadian, A-K-K-A-D-I-A-N. In the Chumash, it's called Kalne. And idolatry of both was very similar. But there are distinct differences between the two empires, and there are distinct differences between their relationships to the Jewish people. And because we are now coming to the end of the series, we have only four more lectures after tonight, which deal with the period of the Tanakh. And Ashur and Bavel have such importance as far as the end of the Jewish story is concerned. I mean, the end of the Jewish story of the First Temple is concerned. So I think it's necessary for us to have background knowledge to understand something about those empires and about those countries. Ashur was the older empire. Bavel is the later empire. And Ashur was concentrated in a number of famous cities. Eventually, it was concentrated in the city of Nineveh. And the city of Nineveh was one of the wonders of the ancient world. And if you want to see a vestige of the glory that once was Ashur, that once was Assyria, you can see it in the British Museum in London, where the winged colonnades of the gates of Nineveh were taken The archaeologists discovered them, and they were taken from Mesopotamia and brought to London, and a substitute gate was built there, and these winged horses, which was the symbol of Assyria, are on display there. Nineveh was one of the major metropolises in the world. We read in the book of Jonah that the population was over 1 million people. It was a tremendously large urban area, well developed, and for the times it probably was what New York or Paris or London is in the world today. It was a center of activity, cultural and economic, and it was the capital of the world when Ashur was the leading empire. Now, the empire of Ashur went through many stages. We have records that date back to the time of Avraham Avinu. Historic records from the year 2000 before the Common Era, which indicate to us the strength of Ashur. And really, the first great emperor of Ashur is Nimrod, who is mentioned in the Tanakh, and he unified all of the tribes after the flood under his reign, and he is the one who attempted to build the great Tower of Babel to reach heaven to establish his authority. Ashur, therefore, initially was very strong. Then, for a long period of time, it was very weak. For almost 600-700 years, it was not a very strong empire. It did not really exert much of an influence on the area. Then, beginning again in about the year 1000 before the Common Era, Ashur begins to rise. And the politics of the world then was that Egypt was always the southern empire and Ashur was the northern empire. They were to counterbalance one to each other, one against each other. And the poor little country of Palestine, of Israel, of Eretz Israel, was the country that lay between these two great, gigantic and voracious empires. Nevertheless, the 10 northern tribes from about the year 900, 850 on, were a powerful group, and they were able to assert themselves against Ashur, and in certain periods of time, they were even able to be stronger than Ashur. They did it through a series of alliances, as I discussed with you when we discussed Ahav and the other strong kings of the northern tribes. They allied themselves with various other tribes, and because of that, they were able to withstand Ashur. But the beginning of the end, as far as the Jewish people are concerned, begins in about the year 790 before the Common Era, when the king of Aram is what is today Lebanon, and a piece of Syria, which is the buffer between Ashur in the north. I mean, in today's geography, it's Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel. So Syria and Lebanon are the buffer between Iraq and the land of Israel. When Aram, under the leadership of the king Ben-Hadad, was unable to withstand any longer the pressure from Ashur, and they made an alliance with Ashur, and eventually they collapsed, and Ashur took them over completely. When that happened, then Ashur was on the doorstep of Israel. As I mentioned to you before, also, Ashur had a very interesting policy regarding neighboring nations and regarding all conquered nations. Its policy was to remove the local indigenous population, to send them away somewhere else, to exile them, and to bring others in their stead. in the words of the rabbis, bilbilis olam, to homogenize the whole world so that nobody was at home wherever they were. The policy was basically military in nature because the new people who came, it would take them a long time to adjust, and they would not have the loyalty to the land, and they wouldn't feel like making a rebellion. And the old people, you sent them away somewhere else completely, they would be so busy surviving, they would not have time to deal with this. And that policy was successful, and it was successful as far as the Jewish people were concerned, because that's how the 10 tribes got lost. He did not take them to one place, and he just scattered them throughout the Assyrian Empire, and eventually they fell apart. Ashur, even though it was idolatrous, was not, I don't know how to put it, was not anti-Jewish per se. It was tolerant of monotheism, maybe because of its antecedents and origins with Avraham Avinu. It was not, monotheism was not unknown to them, and monotheism was not rejected by them. It just wasn't their religion. Ashur's tolerance towards all other religions had a very negative effect upon the Jews. The Jewish people are, as we all know, they're a very strange entity. The truth of the matter is the guarantee of Jewish survival is to tell the Jewish people, no, you can't survive. Once you start that program, then the Jewish people become stubborn. We have countless, innumerable instances of that behavior throughout Jewish history. The last one is now the Jews in the Soviet Union, for instance. If the Jews in the Soviet Union would have been absorbed and assimilated, there is no doubt that they would have been lost completely. And the fact that the communist government refused to do so, that guarantees Jewish survival. Just as in Egypt, the persecution guaranteed Jewish survival, just as throughout the ages. Now, that's a lousy way to have to survive. And if we had our choice, we would opt for perhaps more positive stimuli. But the historic fact is that that's how it worked. And therefore, Ashur was the cause of great assimilation amongst the Jewish people, because they had more or less a tolerant attitude, and they really weren't set to, primed to destroy the Jewish people. And therefore, the Jews had a respect for Ashur. It was a dominant culture, and it was a dominant religion. And many of the idolatries which the Jews unfortunately adopted were patterned on the idols and religion of Ashur of Assyria. Bovel, as we will see in a few moments, was the opposite. Bovel wanted to coerce the Jewish people. Bovel wanted to force the Jewish people to give up Judaism. Well, then you got a tough people. Then they're not willing to do it. Nebuchadnezzar was not noted for his magnanimity or tolerance or goodness. He was not a role model. But the kings, generally speaking, of Ashur were in a very cruel world, in a very cruel time, relatively were benign figures. And therefore, it perhaps helps us understand how the 10 tribes of Israel could just disappear, just assimilate and disappear. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Jews, just disappear within a relatively short period of time. But anyone who's been part and parcel of the American experience sees how in a century, almost 80% of American Jewry has disappeared as effective Jews. In one century, And that if we're not for God's promise and for the stubbornness of the other one-fifth, then all the demographic predictions regarding the demise of American Jewry certainly would be accurate. Well, that in effect is what happened to the 10 northern tribes. They were assimilated into the Assyrian society in such a sense that within a generation, two generations, by the third generation, they did not remember that they were Jewish. They just did not remember. And there are millions of people walking around the world today who are descended from Jews and who don't know that they're Jewish. That's true of Spain, where the estimates of the historians are that perhaps three-quarters of the Spaniards have Jewish blood in them, all the way back to the Muranos and to the Jewish settlement in Spain. And that's true all over. And it's becoming more and more true here in the United States. I had a painter paint my house, the outside of my house, last week. And when it was all over, and he came in the house and he saw my library and all of the Sforim and all of the books, and he said, oh, they're all in Hebrew, and he starts asking and everything. And after a while, it comes out that his grandfather was Jewish. He's raised as a Roman Catholic. He's married to a Protestant. Their children are goyim. They go to church, etc. But his grandfather was Jewish. And when he saw all the Hebrew books, it awakened within him an interest regarding Judaism and Jewish. And you know, he wants to know if he could learn Hebrew. He'd like to know about his grandfather. So I'm not a sociologist, but I would hazard to say that there are tens of thousands of such people walking around. But in the assimilatory climate of the society that we live in, it's very possible. His children will not know that they had a Jewish great-grandfather. And it's just disappeared. He knows enough to ask me if whether the Reformed Temple would consider him Jewish, because his grandfather was Jewish. He knows that the Orthodox, I mean, I hired him to paint the house under the condition that he was not Jewish. But he wants to know what the Reform would say. But his grandchild will certainly not even want to know that. That I think that, and I have support for that theory for many things that the Mephorshim say. That's in essence what happened to the 10 tribes of Israel. Now the legend of the 10 tribes is that they are exiled en masse to one specific place, and that they are all waiting redemption for the time of the Mashiach. And they're behind a magical river, Sambatyon. There's that entire legend that has become part and parcel of the Jewish tradition. And halavai, it would be true. But the opinion of the Talmud and Sanhedrin is that the Aseres HaShvatim are gone, that the 10 tribes are not coming back. There are individuals amongst us who are descended from the 10 tribes, but the 10 tribes as an entity, as a unit, they're not here, they're gone. How did they disappear? They assimilated. That's how they disappeared. No one took them and put them into the ovens. No one gassed them to death. No one was coercive. Assyria was a freestanding empire, so to speak. It was it had a lot of tolerance for the time, at least, a lot of tolerance. We see also from Assyria and the story of Jonah and Nineveh that they were not that far from Jewish ideals and Jewish ideas. They did tshuva overnight. They knew what the Navi was talking about. I mean, there are many places in the world and large segments of society in the world, in my opinion, that if the Navi came to speak to them today, they wouldn't know what he's talking about. What are they supposed to do? What does it mean that he'll come and announce in 40 days, you know, Tokyo is going to be destroyed? So what are they going to do? Do tshuva. I mean, it just doesn't, there's no place to start. Nineveh knew exactly what he meant. And they knew exactly what they had to do. Because they had within themselves a kernel of Jewish morality, of the ideas that are involved. Which brings us to a very short and not very analytical discussion of the Hammurabi codes, which are codes from Assyria, from ancient Assyria, which bear somewhat of a resemblance to codes in the Torah. So the Bible critics, in their hatred for anything that's Jewish and anything that's holy, said that the Torah, so to speak, copied its civil law and its law regarding damages, etc., from Hammurabi. Which is like saying, you know, that that Rembrandt copied from a guy that paints by numbers. But the code of Hammurabi does have resemblances. And those resemblances are built into the people of Assyria, into the culture. They were not strangers to many of the ideas of the Torah. They were not strangers to the ideas. And since Avraham Avinu and his family came from that place in the world, and during the time of Avraham they were very influential there, it can be understood, it's almost logical to say that that these ideas, these similarities were implanted within them early on, and they remain part of their culture and part of their viewpoint of the world, and that's why the Jews were able to fit in. When the Jews went to Assyria, they could fit in. If in 1880, 1881, when great Jewish emigration from Russia began, so between 1881 and 1914, about 2 million Eastern European Jews came to the United States. If those 2 million Jews would have gone to Tanganyika, or if they would have gone to Japan, or if they would have gone to Malaysia, the Jews would not have assimilated. Because the culture and the values of the society were of such a nature that the Jews would not have found it under any circumstances to be a society in which they could easily assimilate. But when they came to the United States, they came to a free, basic Christian religious society that subscribed to the same moral tenets. So it was not that strange, and it was therefore easy to assimilate, because if you took on the guise of being a good American, I remember when I grew up, everybody used to say at the bar mitzvah speech that he wanted to be a good Jew and a good American. You had to say you wanted to be a good American. But being a good American and a good Jew were somehow synonymous. There was nothing in American life or American ideals that a good Jew wouldn't want. Adarabba, that was the proof that you were a good American. Just the opposite. Today, when nobody wants to be a good American, so you don't have to say that. You know, we're embarrassed of chauvinistic patriotism, of making statements such as that. It doesn't go anymore. There'll come a time that'll probably come back into vogue, but right now it's still not quite there. But the that was the idea of Assyria. And the Jews came to Ashur, they had a place to go. They had a place to assimilate into. You could be a good Jew and a good Assyrian. Well, if you're a good Jew and a good Assyrian, after two generations, you were just plain Assyrian. And another great difference was that the Jews who came to Assyria, the Jews who came to Ashur, basically were not very strong Jews. They themselves came from the northern ten tribes. The northern ten tribes had for hundreds of years already worshipped idols. For hundreds of years they were backsliders. Their commitment to Judaism was not extremely strong and deep. So when you have that combination of weak Jews and an assimilatory society that one can fit into, so then it's not that difficult for us to understand what happened to the ten tribes, how they disappeared as they did. They just simply intermarried, assimilated, they sank into the woodwork, so to speak. They became part of the society they lived in. So in the year 732, when Sanherib, who was also called Sargon, when he exiled the tribes and he took them away, so 150 years later, at the time of the Churban Bayis Rishon, 150 years later was four, five, six generations later, there were no Jews. They were gone. And when the next wave of Jews came, they did not come to Ashur, they came to Bovel. And that was a great difference. Bovel was composed of three different groups, the Babylonian Empire. The Babylonian Empire was always subservient to Ashur until the last 100 and 110 years. Of the existence of the entire Mesopotamian kingdom until the time that it was overrun by the Persians. By the way, the Iran-Iraq war that we are witness to in our time is just a continuation of the Iran-Iraq war that was going on 2,600 years ago and probably was going on 3,600 years ago. I mean, the Ayatollah, he isn't that old, but he represents that ferocity that has always gone into that battle between the Persians and the Medes on one hand and between the Mesopotamians on the other hand. That's why any student of history finds the efforts of our State Department naive, to put it mildly. To think, you know, that you're going to make a trip and you'll settle it. You know, they think it's like refereeing the NBA. You know, you'll settle it. It's a millennia-old struggle. And the same thing is true about the struggle in Lebanon, which has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. It didn't start now. And to think that it's given the easy solution. And unfortunately, one probably has to say the same thing regarding the struggle of the Arabs and the Jews regarding Eretz Israel, is that it's not a struggle it's not since Zionism, and it's not the last 40 years of the State of Israel. It's Yitzchak and Yishmael. It has very, very ancient antecedents, and therefore these ancient struggles are not given to easy solutions. They are not ameliorated by good intentions. So beginning in about the year 680, Bovel, 680 before the Common Era, Bovel began to gain strength as an empire. And the strength that Bovel was from the three groups that composed it. One group was from Aram, meaning Syrians, who comprised part of the territory of Bovel. The second were the Kasdim, the Chaldeans, which were a specific Semitic tribe. And the third tribe were the Babylonians themselves, who lived, as I mentioned to you, in the southern part of the area bounded by the Tigris and the Euphrates, bordering on the Persian Gulf. These three groups solidified, unified, and they became the dominant force. They were very intelligent. They were more intelligent than the Assyrians. And the Assyrians had shot their bolt. The worst thing for an empire is to be on top, because then there's only one way to go. at the moment of one's greatest triumph, the seeds of its destruction are immediately planted. There has been no exception to that in human history either, which gives us pause in this country. I always give a different example. Today, as you know, is the 21st day of June. It's allegedly the longest day of the year. That means that beginning tomorrow, winter is coming. That's Litvak's way of looking at the world, even though it's going to be 95 degrees tomorrow. But you understand what I'm saying, winter, right? If once you're at the longest day, so then winter is coming, right? Well, once Assyria was on top, so then it had nowhere to go, and the Babylonians were ready to accommodate it. The Babylonians were always second fiddle to the Assyrians, and they were always treated as such. They were second-class citizens of the Assyrian Empire. They didn't have the benefits, etc. Now, when their turn will come, they will show them no mercy. They're going to run the show. And really, the most ruthless and strongest king of the Babylonian Empire is the man who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, Nebuchadnezzar. Or is he sometimes called Nebuchadrezzar? He was a king for half a century. According to the Mephoshim, he lived to be almost 100. He lived from about the year 670 to about the year 570, before the Common Era. And he is the one who, more than anyone else, made Babylonia into the leading empire in the world, into the only empire, and he defeated Egypt. He is the first. Chazal say that there are a number of people that's called Molach Bekipo. They ruled. So the Bekipo doesn't mean what a Yamalke. What it means is Molach Bekipo, that they ruled over the globe. They like sat on the world. The absolute tyrant of the world. And he was one of them. He was what Alexander the Great would be later. What the Roman emperors would be later, except he was stronger than the Roman emperors because he did not have to deal with a Senate or with conflicting politics. He was it. How did he get to be that? And what's the whole story above him? So here you have the Jewish viewpoint, right? If you take an article, you can take an article in the Encyclopedia Britannica, look up Babylonia, it'll tell you how Babylonia became great. Or read Breasted's History of the Ancient World, it'll tell you how Babylonia became great. But that's not how Babylonia became great. I mean, it is, but it isn't, right? We want to tell you the real story, the inside story. There always are six or seven stories. That's why there are so many books written on events in the world. Because even after you know the story, you don't know it unless the insider tells you exactly what happened. And Chazal were the insiders here. Chazal knew the story. So in the first year of his reign, so let's discuss how he became the king. This is based on a Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that the king of Babylonia then was Merodach Biladan. Merodach Biladan is his name. And then there's Evil Merodach, who is also in the family, and where, by the way, the English word evil comes from. So that describes, you know, him. So Evil Merodach had an alliance with King Chizkio, with Chizkio HaMelech in Yehuda. Their alliance was based upon the defeat of Ashur at the gates of Jerusalem. So the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That's the rule in the Middle East. The rule has not changed, and that was the rule then. Bovel was interested in supporting Yehuda, even though it eventually would destroy Yehuda. But temporarily, it was interested in supporting Yehuda because Yehuda and Bovel together were against Ashur, against the Assyrian Empire. So Chizkiyahu, the king of Yehuda, became ill, as I discussed with you in our in the brilliant lecture on Chizkiyahu that we had a few weeks ago. Almost brilliant. So the Gemara says that Chizkiyahu recovered from his illness. So Merodach Biladan sent him a get well card. Sent him a letter, how happy we are that the great king of Judah has come back to his health, has been restored. So he wrote in the letter, Shalom Lamelech Chizkiyahu, peace be unto the great king Chizkiyahu, Shalom Leir Yerushalayim, peace to the great city of Jerusalem, Shalom Lelokim Agodol, peace to the great God of Israel. So the God of Israel he put third. Now Nebuchadnezzar, who then was a very young man, he was a scribe in the king's entourage, and he was a very young man. He wasn't present when the letter was written. When he came and the letter was being sent, he asked one of his fellow scribes, how was the letter written? So they told him, we wrote peace to the king Chizkiyahu, peace to the city of Jerusalem. They wrote him the text, peace to the great God of Israel. So he said, how could you do that? How could you mention God last? God should be mentioned first. It should read, peace to the great God of Israel. And then peace to the great city of Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is more holy than a person. And then it should have said, peace to the king Chizkiyahu. And the Gemara says that he took four steps to bring back the messenger. You know, the guy outside, Federal Express, that was taking the letter, the guy was right standing right by the fax machine. He ran over to stop him. So he took four steps. So the Gemara says that for every step that he took, he was given a generation of dynasty to be the emperor of Bovel. He, his son, his grandson, his great-grandson. And the Gemara says that the Malach came, the Malach Gavriel came and stopped him after four steps, because if he would have kept on going, the Babylonian Empire would have lasted eternally to the detriment of the Jewish people. The Jewish people did much better under the Persians. So the Malach came and stopped him. But the four steps that he took, that is what made him the emperor. What's the Gemara telling us here? He became the emperor because he had more respect for God than the previous king of Bovel. He had more respect for God than the Assyrians had. So even though he's a greater Russia, Nebuchadnezzar is one of the worst Rishoyim in the history of the world. But somehow the two things are not mutually exclusive. It's possible to be a terrible person, a great Russia, and yet to have your head screwed on straight, to see, you know, to have that understanding of that God's name should go first and not last. The Talmud tells us Nebuchadnezzar was a dwarf. It's interesting. I mentioned to you regarding Paro that he was a dwarf. Apparently, there are a lot of people in the ancient world that was a dwarf. And Gemara says here a tremendous insight. That people who have severe physical handicaps, who are crippled or dwarfed, or have other severe physical handicaps, if they rise to positions of power, they are much more cruel than a person that is normal. Because they don't have to work out their insecurities, don't have to work out their feelings of frustration and anger. They don't have to work out the psychological problems that come, unfortunately, with handicaps. Because it's not just the physical handicap. Every person We all have mental handicaps, but sometimes physical handicaps cause severe mental handicaps. When all of that happens, so that explains, in the Talmud's eyes, that explains Nebuchadnezzar. It explains all of his cruelty, because he was a dwarf. And the Gemara says, like all dwarfs, you know, they underestimated him. They said, oh, you know, that's going to be the king. You know, he's done nothing. And when he therefore took power, he showed them that he was not a nothing. He showed them that he was a something. Now, Bovel had a very strong religion of paganism. And Bovel was not tolerant of anyone else. Bovel insisted that everyone convert to their religion. And the king himself was associated with the religion. It's as though the king was the god. A little like in Japan, where the emperor until our time was himself a deity. So that part of the culture of the country, part of the patriotism, the loyalty of the country was that the king was deified. The king was the idol that was worshipped. And we see that in the Tanakh, that Nebuchadnezzar insisted that they bow down to him. And that he be treated as a god. He had these delusions. I don't know whether originally when it starts out, the person believes it or not. I don't have that experience yet. I mean, one can believe that he's a rabbi. You can talk yourself into that. And you can talk yourself into the fact that you're a Rosh Yeshiva. You know, enough people talk to you in the third person. So after a while, you also talk about yourself in the third person. Somebody called me up one night, like 1 a.m. So he said, is the Rosh Yeshiva there? I said, the Rosh Yeshiva is sleeping. And I hung up. But after a while, you can convince yourself that, you know, that you're the Rosh Yeshiva too. So it could be that originally he didn't think he was a god, but after a while, everybody calls you a god, and after a while, everybody bows to you and treats you like a god, so after a while, you believe you're a god. And that's the danger always of any position that gives a person honor, is that it's very difficult to control the person afterwards. He takes it seriously. He starts to believe in it. And all of that together can literally be fatal to the person. The Talmud tells us that not only was it an idolatrous society, it was a homosexual society. And we have such in the ancient world, and we live in such a time in the modern world as well. The world goes through cycles. But during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar and Bovel was a society where homosexuality was not only accepted, it became the norm. It was the means, as by the Greeks later, it was the means of expression of companionship and love. And the Talmud tells us regarding Nebuchadnezzar himself that he was a homosexual. He was bisexual because he had children also, but that basically he was homosexual inclined. And that was the style in Bovel. That was not, it was not viewed as an aberration. It was not viewed as something to be seen, to be treated, but that was the style. And then the third thing that characterized Bovel was that it was a society of great cruelty. They did not have the United Way. They didn't have, you know, toys for orphans. They didn't have, it resembled Sdom in many, many respects. I think that's the best way that I could describe it, is that Bovel had an affinity to what Sdom was in the time of Avram. Was a hard society, a tough society. No one helped anybody else out. Homosexuality was accepted. Idolatry was accepted. Violence was accepted. That's the society. And therefore, it is little wonder that Jews were not basically attracted to that society. And that's why the Jews that went into exile in Bovel immediately made their own ghetto, and they made their own yeshivas, and their own shtiblach, and their own shul, and they were not interested in becoming part of Babylonian society. And the Jews remained in Babylonia 1,500 years and never assimilated, because the nature of society was so foreign to them. The assimilatory process throughout Jewish history is always more dependent upon the Gentile society than upon the Jews. In a friendly, conducive Gentile society, non-Jewish society, Jews are always ready to assimilate. But when the society is not of that nature, when the society doesn't allow that to happen easily, either for political or religious or social reasons, so then the Jewish entity is much more easily preserved. Now the Talmud tells us that in the first year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar marched against the city of Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria, and he captured it, and he destroyed Nineveh, the great city. According to many historians, he razed it to the ground as a symbol that the capital was now Bovel, and he made the great city of Bovel, of Babylon, he made that the great city in the Middle East. And we have that one of the wonders, it's told, one of the wonders of the ancient world were the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. He also went to great lengths, as did all of the emperors and strongmen of the time, to leave an archaeological record, to leave an architectural impression, to build things that he felt would survive eternally, and things that were so beautiful and so unusual that even we who are removed from the scene 2,500 years, we still know that there was such a famous thing as the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and that it was a remarkable, wondrous feat, and that tourists came from all over the world to see it. After conquering Assyria, he then consolidated all of the Assyrian Empire under him. And in the seventh year of his reign, he came and he conquered Jehoiachin. And he took them into exile into Bovel in the eighth year of his reign. And he installed Tzidkiyahu to be his puppet king of Yehuda, whom we're going to talk about. We have in one of the final lectures here, we have an entire lecture on Tzidkiyahu. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's policy was Bovel's policy was directly opposite to that of Ashur. Ashur's policy was to transpose population. His policy was to control the population by terror, by puppets and by terror. He appointed new governors that were loyal to him, and that really was the system that the Romans would use much later, the system that the Nazis would use, that the population didn't have to be moved, but it had to be cowed. It had to be beaten into submission, and that it was possible to do so, and the way to do so was through terror. Random terror, but that the terror had to have the purpose of pointing out to the population that they lived at the whim and the will of the king, of the conqueror, and that they should harbor no illusions of revolution or of improving their lot or of changing the situation. All of that was automatically not only forbidden, but it was silly to think of it. And that was his policy. Our rabbis described that Nebuchadnezzar, even though he was a dwarf, was a man of immense courage. They said that he trained the lion in the palace and he rode the lion bareback. And that he had poisonous snakes that he would play with. And once in a while, he would let a python or a cobra or a boa constrictor, he'd let him, eat one of the courtiers in the palace that day he didn't feel so pleasantly disposed towards it. The reason that I'm giving you these illustrations is so that you'll have a picture of what kind of a madman we're talking about. And what kind of reign of terror we're talking about. And this is half a century this goes on. It isn't like he's going to be out of office in 50 days and we just have to survive a little while. And that also helps to explain all the stories that we have in Tanakh and the book of Daniel about Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, whom he threw in the furnace of fire, Daniel, whom he threw in the lion's den. Those were not uncommon events. They were daily events in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. Every day somebody got thrown in the furnace. Every day somebody got thrown in the lion's den. And he was a very, very difficult person, to put it mildly. Chazal have on him such a negative statement that they say that if one travels today to Bovel and sees the archaeological ruins of his palace, I don't know whether they can be seen today, but in the time of the Gemara, it still could be seen 1,500 years ago. So they had a special brocha that the Gemara in Brochas tells us, Boruch Shehecheriv Beso Shel Nebuchadnezzar. Blessed be God that he destroyed the palace, the home, the dynasty of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was just evil incarnate. And the Medrash says that there's a pasuk in Chavakuk, Oyom Venorahu, referring to the evil that will come upon the Jewish people, Oyom Venorahu, that it is terrible, it's awesome, it's indescribable in the immensity of its terror. That's the description of Nebuchadnezzar. So we, Nebuch, in our time, also have some understanding of that, right? The Germans have taught us that, the Russians have taught us that. That there's no limit to the bounds of cruelty. There's no limit to the madness that exists in the world. That everything can happen and unfortunately does happen. But Nebuchadnezzar was a rude shock to the Jewish people. And because of that, it should only serve to reinforce in our minds the greatness of what was done by the Jews in Bovel. How they were able to survive, how they were able to build Jewish life in Bovel, in such a society, in a society that was inimical to its lifestyle and to its values, that was intolerant, that was violent, that was terror. And in spite of all of this, the Jewish people were successful. And he brooked, the Babylonians in general, brooked no sign of rebellion. We know the famous verse in Psalms, the famous chapter in Psalms, in Tehillim, that the captors of Israel, the Babylonians, said to the Levim, Shiru lanu mishirei Tzion, sing for us the songs of Zion. And they answered, the Jews answered, Eich noshir eshir Hashem al ad masnecha. How shall we sing the songs of God on foreign soil, in an alien country, in such a society, we are unable to do so. So the chapter of Tehillim does not tell us what was the fate of the Jews who answered like that. So one could be led to think that, you know, that it was heroic. And the king said, sing, and we said, don't sing. And the king was so impressed by our courage and our tenacity and our sincerity and honesty that we didn't want to sing the Shirim or the Beis HaMikdash in Bovel, that he said, gee, what a fine people, you know, let's give them Borough Park. But that's not what happened. The Medrash says that he killed 80,000 Jews. That his response to their refusal was a massacre, was a Holocaust. That was his response. So that's important because otherwise we have a false picture of what Bovel was. We have a false picture of what the exile was. What makes it even more difficult, therefore, is to understand, and I'll discuss that also in one of the last lectures that we have, is why didn't the Jews leave Bovel when they had a chance to? So one of the reasons that's ordinarily given is because Bovel was great. You know, that's like with the Jews in America. Why don't we leave, right? Because we cannot take our Audi or along with us, right? We can't take our homes and our comfort. So that's why we don't leave. So we think that somehow was the reason why the Jews from Bovel also didn't leave. But the answer, I think, is, I don't think that's a correct answer, because Bovel was no picnic. So it's more complicated than that. The best estimates are that if the Soviet Union, and who can tell, I mean, these are only estimates, I don't know how accurate they are, but they are constantly repeated, that if the Soviet Union would open its borders today and allow everyone who wanted to emigrate to leave, then 400,000 Jews would leave, but 2 million Jews would stay. Which is a pretty good percentage, because you don't have a fifth of American Jewry leaving and the borders are open. But on one hand, that's great, 400,000 will leave. On the other hand, I mean, what in God's name, what's wrong with the 2 million? What are they staying for? That's a difficult problem to deal with. And Bovel will highlight that for us, because the society that the Jews went into in Bovel was not peaches and cream. This man was a very, very crazy man. Later, under the Persians, it would improve, but it never achieved the type of freedom and grandeur that we sometimes invested with, that we sometimes think that isn't what happened there. And because of that, then you have this entire picture of the Babylonian Empire, far different empire than the Assyrian Empire, much more ruthless, much more anti-Jewish, much more violent, much stronger. Man, I think that's what the Gemara has in mind, that the Talmud tells us that the angel came and stopped them after four steps. Empires such as these, if they are allowed to keep on going for a long period of time, then the world will not survive it. comes to a point when they have to stop. The relative length has to be shorter than, so the Assyrian Empire lasted almost 400 years. The Babylonian Empire will be over in 120 years. And the reason for it is because of its completely evil nature. Just anything negative that you can imagine, that's what it was. And in that lies the secret of many, many things. I think that that also helps to explain why some Jews went to Egypt and not to Babylonia, even though there's a law to go to Egypt. Babylonia was a fearsome place. And Jews went there, Jews were dragged there. They didn't go there willingly. But once they came there, they didn't assimilate for the very reasons that made it so fearsome. So that's probably the silver lining in the dark cloud of this comparison of the relationship between Ashur and Bavel and the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Yehuda and the Beis HaMikdash itself.